Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's announcement from the White House that President Obama is cancelling his summit meeting with Russian President Putin, but will attend the G20 meeting in St. Petersburg. Kimberly Martin, the director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University, joins us to discuss how much the Snowden affair affected the decision and the other irritants besetting bilateral relations like Putin's assault on LGBT rights. Then we'll speak with media analyst Robert McChesney, co-author with John Nichols, of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Following the purchase of the Washington Post by billionaire owner of Amazon, we will look into how failing newspapers and magazines are becoming playthings for billionaires and discuss the collapse of the news media, in which professionalism has been replaced by commercialism as resources for reporting are cut and investigative journalism is all but eliminated. Then finally, we'll examine the most lucrative part of the Washington Post company that was not sold to Jeff Bezos, and that is the Kaplan for-profit division, which accounts for 55% of the company's revenue. David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, where he has an article, Bezos' Purchase of the Post Leaves Graham with Kaplan For-Profit College, which is also at the Huffington Post, joins us to discuss how the Post's former owner got the White House to water down rules that would have held these predatory diploma mills that saddle students with crippling debt accountable. I'm now speaking with Kimberly Martin, who is the director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and a professor of political science at Barnard College. Her books include Enforcing the Peace, Learning from the Imperial Past, Weapons, Culture, and Self-Interest, Soviet Defense Managers in the New Russia, and Engaging the Enemy, Organization Theory and Soviet Military Innovation. Her latest book is Warlords, Strong-Armed Brokers in Weak States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kimberly Martin.
Ian, thank you so much for having me on your show. Just to clarify, I'm back to being a normal professor. I stopped being the Harriman director on July 1st.
Oh, you did? All right.
Yes.
Well, okay. I will revise that in the next time go around. But let me what was your response to, or your reaction to, first of all, these announcements came from the White House, but they were fairly heavily telegraphed by President Obama in a conversation with Jay Leno on The Tonight Show. So it's pretty amazing, isn't it, that this important news gets broken with a comedian?
Well, I think that nothing that happened has been really unexpected. It was very clear as soon as Putin made the decision that Snowden would receive temporary asylum that Obama really had no choice at that point except to cancel the personal part of the summit with Putin in September in Moscow.
So when the president talked about Putin, it was pretty. It's pretty clear that they really don't have a particularly good relationship. That shouldn't come as a surprise. It's also, I think, your point is well taken that when he announced that he had that he was giving Snowden a year's political asylum, it occurred to me that he knew that what would follow. But what the president said here to Leno was interesting. Just about Putin, he said, there have been times when they slip back into Cold War thinking and Cold War mentalities. And what I consistently say to them and what I say to President Putin is that that's the past, and we've got to think about the future. And there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to cooperate more effectively than we do. So I guess that's a little window into the kind of dialogue that they have. What do you think?
Well, I think there was a real opportunity this past spring that both Putin and Obama tried to take advantage of to try to make some personal headway in the relationship, even though the politics on each side are very difficult for domestic political reasons on both the Russian side and the American side. But in May, before the summit that happened on the side of the previous G8 meeting that happened in Northern Ireland, Obama sent a personal note to Putin outlining some possibilities for cooperation, and Putin responded with some ideas in return, and Putin chose to publicize this in the Russian press. So that was the first sense we had that maybe Putin was really trying to reach out to Obama now that both of them were in their next revised terms of office. I think that there was also some sense more recently despite some of the awkwardness of the June summit in Northern Ireland, that Putin made a comment that he was interested in, potentially working with Obama as a person, even if the politics were difficult in Washington, because he thought that Obama was sincere, just maybe not in control of his own political situation at home. And I think given that headway that was being made, Snowden really threw a wrench into everything. It was not an appearance in Moscow that Moscow valued particularly. Putin didn't ask Snowden to come. Putin tried very hard to keep the fallout from it limited. As July was going on, there were certainly earlier opportunities that Putin could have immediately granted asylum to Snowden, and he tried to head it off. But I think what's really happening is that Putin is facing a very difficult set of circumstances at home, not really among the Russian public, which doesn't have that much impact on policy, but instead among the personal relationships among other actors at the top. And really, it's a patronage political network situation, and Putin has to balance off the interests of various members of that network in order to keep his own hold on power.
Well, if he doesn't care about the narod, the public, out, and his most of his support is out in the country, the city where the Kremlin is, where he works, is hostile territory, isn't it? So, how does he navigate? How much does he care, for example, about what the oligarchs think? Sure, most Russian businessmen are more open-minded and pro-Western and my understanding is that they need a lot of investment in the energy sector. So these reactionary moves of his part, and particularly this anti-gay bill that the Duma passed that he's behind, it even has a kind of clause in it that allows for vigilantism. I mean, you'd have to go back to the Nazi period to find something so distasteful as that. So how much of Putin out on the limb in terms of offending the intelligentsia?
Oh, there's so many different points to your question, so let me grab onto two of them in particular. I think, first of all, there are just a wide variety of networks that are really pretty opaque, that we can't really tell who's in them for sure. But we know that there is some kind of a conflict happening at the very top in the Kremlin between people who are part of what's known as the Siloviki, the power ministry network, the people who are represented by the old hardline KGB factions, probably also supported by defense industry, certainly by some people in the oil industry. But then at the same time, as you mentioned, there is this economic interest. There are certainly very strong members of the elite in Russia who have an interest in trying to expand their trade relationships with the outside world. And so Putin is right now trying to keep a balance in between these networks at a time when all kinds of things are happening in Russia that really were not probably anticipated by the leadership as a result of the political protests that have been happening over the last couple of years, and then most recently because of the protests that we've seen with the Navalny case. So that's the first thing. The second thing on the gay rights issue, I think you're absolutely right. And I think what we're seeing in recent days is really a triumph of civil society at a global level, with people not being willing to sit back and allow the Russian policies to go forward without criticism and to make a hinge statement about it because of what's happening with the Sochi Olympics. And you're absolutely right that the parallel that's being drawn in the press and by some people in academia is indeed to the Hitler Olympics that happened back in 1936 when Hitler tried to put a good face on what was happening in the Nazi party and the growth of Nazism in Germany by hiding from the outside world just what was happening. And I think what we're seeing in the last couple of days is civil society at a global level saying we're not going to let what's happening to gay rights in Russia be hidden.
But the first network that you referred to, my understanding is that, it's been often referred to as KGB Incorporated, the
yes.
Oil and gas and the ministries, and particularly the military-industrial complex. I thought Putin put all of his people in those ministries and that's what he controls. So is that – you're saying that he's even finding problems with them?
Well, the thing to keep in mind is that when Putin came into power, it was a very sudden rise out of obscurity. And so when we're talking about Putin's people, it's not exactly clear. I mean, certainly over time, Putin has gained more and more authority and power inside the Russian state, so he has more control. But originally it was not Putin's people. It was a coalition of people that included Putin. But one of the reasons that Putin has had such a successful time in Russian politics has been his ability to try to make compromises and to try to balance all of the different interests that are really at the top of society. And even in the energy complex, we see some real differences between some of the oil industry, for example, Rosneft, the big state oil company, and Gazprom, the big natural gas company. Both are state-controlled, and yet their interests are often in competition against each other, and they do represent different factions within the elite. And so Putin does not have an easy job. It's not that he is an authoritarian leader who can just point straight down and tell everybody what to do. It's instead the case that there are a variety of informal networks that have different forms of political and economic power, and he really needs to balance among them.
Again, I'm speaking with Kimberly Martin, who is a professor of political science at Barnard College and formerly the director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. And her latest book is Warlords, Strong-Arm Brokers in Weak States. So in terms of canceling this summit after the president, of course, is going to go to the G20 meeting in early September in St. Petersburg. Apparently there are not going to be any side meetings with Putin, so they pretty much closed the door on that. How do you think it's playing? There's a certain indignation in the way that the Russians are reporting it, but, you know, going back to Winston Churchill's adage, you know, jaw, jaw, jaw is better than war, war, war. what do you think we're gaining and what are we losing?
Well, I think the important jawing is going to take place tomorrow, as long as the Russians don't decide to withdraw from it. And that's the meeting of the foreign ministers and the defense ministers that's happening in Washington, D.C., where the Russian foreign and defense ministers are meeting their American counterparts, Secretary of State Kerry and Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel. And so as long as that goes forward, that is much more likely to be a place where the truly substantive issues get discussed, where the issues that have real geopolitical significance, such as Iran, Syria, North Korea, potentially even further nuclear arms control, that's where real headway can be made. And in a sense, the personal meeting between Putin and Obama that was planned was diplomatic icing on the cake, maybe a little bit diplomatic fluff, more than where the real issues actually take place.
But what about the really key issue, which I understand is very, very important, and that is, and so far the Russians have apparently indicated they'll cooperate, the U.S. has a real problem in getting out of Afghanistan and getting all that heavy equipment out, and the Pakistanis have been gouging them. So they've decided to send everything, all the heavy equipment through the stands with Russia's blessing, but Russia could pull the plug on that. It would be a catastrophe to leave all that material, war material, behind.
Well, there's been cooperation on that one particular issue on Afghanistan. Also, there's been cooperation on North Korea. There's been a fair amount of cooperation on Iran. But you're right. At the moment, Afghanistan is the key issue of cooperation. Russia has been very cooperative on that now for at least 2 years. And I don't think we see any signs of Russia wanting to pull back on that for a couple of reasons. One is that the United States and Russia really share some important interests when it comes to what's happening in Afghanistan. You know, Russia is very much afraid of extremist Islamist insurgency in its own southern border regions. Russia is very concerned about narco-trafficking and what that means for drug addiction and the heroin trade in Russia itself. You know, for all of those reasons, Russia doesn't really have an interest in having things in Afghanistan go badly. I think it's also important to keep in mind that one of the things that motivates all of this informal networking that we've been talking about at the top in Moscow is economic interests. And Russia gets an economic payoff, as its allies do in Central Asia, for helping the United States with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. So it's not like they're just volunteering to do this out of the goodness of their heart, rather than getting both geopolitical benefits and economic benefits from the cooperation there.
So is this then more of a personal snub? Because Putin is clearly a vain man. He had some Botox recently, which I think makes him – I don't think it was entirely successful.
He's going to the bottom of the ocean.
Right. And the president was – I thought was pretty blunt on Jay Leno talking about Putin's anti-gay jihad, saying, I have no patience for countries that try to treat gays and lesbians or transgender people in ways that intimidate them or are harmful to them. And then answering the question about what will happen with the Olympics next year in Russia. The president said, I think Putin and Russia have a big stake in making sure the Olympics work. And I think they understand that for most of the countries that participate in the Olympics, we wouldn't tolerate gays or lesbians being treated differently. So it feels to me like there's a bit of a train wreck coming there, isn't it? Tons of money have been spent. Massive amounts have been embezzled. There's rumors that maybe he's going to marry his Olympic gold medalist girlfriend and throw this big party for the world. But maybe there's going to be a lot of room for him to be embarrassed.
Well, you know, it was really interesting on the Leno show last night that Obama also talked about his own difficulties as he's aging and playing basketball. And that was the same point that he raised with the summit meeting with Putin in June, trying to make a joke about the two of them having difficulty playing their sports as they aged. Now, unfortunately, Putin didn't really take that as a joke. And the reason is that for this need to appeal to his internal network, appearing to be strong is very, very important to Putin. That's part of the reason why he can't let the United States be seen to be pushing him around. He has to be seen as standing up to American pressure. But it's also why he dove to the bottom of the ocean recently. When Obama tried to make that joke about both men aging and therefore having a more difficult time playing sports when he met him in June, I'm not sure whether Obama realized that he was really cutting very deeply at something that mattered a great deal to Putin's projection of power at home, which that is that he has to seem like the super athletic macho man who's in control of everything. I think that the biggest concern about the Olympics is probably from the Russian perspective, much less on the gay rights issue. I don't think that no matter what happens on that issue, I don't think that that's going to be something that really harms Putin all that much among his core constituency. Because unfortunately, I don't think at the moment that that gay rights is something that has all that much popular appeal in Russia. The society in general tends to be more conservative than the United States. And so I don't think that particular issue is going to hurt him at home no matter what happens. But I think a real danger of the Sochi Olympics is the possibility of some kind of a terrorist threat. As you know, Sochi is right on the border of the North Caucasus. What has sort of fallen on the wayside in news reporting in recent weeks with everything that's happening with the Snowden case is the fact that there's still, you know, quite a bit of violence that's happening in that region some of the leaders of the North Caucasus insurgency have indicated that they intend to target the Sochi Olympics.
Well, Kimberly Martin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Kimberly Martin, who's a professor of political science at Barnard College and was formerly the director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. And her latest book is Warlords, Strong-Arm Brokers in Weak States. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Robert McChesney about how media properties are becoming billionaire playthings.
Reflects our democracy. Those praying voices on the right of the house are echoed down the street of shame, where politics mix with bingo and tits in a money and numbers game, where they offer you a feature on stockings and suspenders next to a call for stiffer penalties.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert McChesney, who's the Gutskill Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He has written several books on media and politics, hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. Robert McChesney and John Nichols have co-authored The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again, Will the Last Reporter Turn Out the Lights, The Collapse of Journalism, and What Can Be Done to Fix It. And he is the author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. His latest book, co-authored with John Nichols, is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert McChesney.
Pleasure to be here, Ian.
And I take it that that you're concerned here that these media properties that have been up for sale, Newsweek for the second time, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times is on, and the Chicago Tribune are on the block, and there's even rumors that the Koch brothers might buy one or both. That you're concerned that these media properties are becoming playthings for billionaires, and that we are so pathetic, in a sense, that our best hope is that we end up with a benevolent, benign billionaire buying them. Is that how bad it is?
Well, I wouldn't put it necessarily exclusive like that. But the context, I think, that's important here, and what I guess I'm trying to do when I talk about the Bezos story with the Washington Post or even the Koch brothers story is to say, look, let's look at the broader context, which is that the value of commercial journalist properties, and we look primarily at newspapers, those are the last people doing journalism with reporters for the most part, but the value has plummeted because Wall Street has decided, and I think for good reason, that there's no profits to be made doing journalism anymore. It's no longer a commercially viable undertaking. And investors are voting with their feet. You know, the resources going to journalism have plummeted in the last 20 years, probably down to 30-40% of what they were on a per capita basis, say 1992. And we're seeing newsrooms just drying up, like there's been, you know, a dust bowl hit them or something. And so what's happened as a result of that is that some of the great monopoly properties of the past, the great newspapers, have seen their prices plummet, and billionaires willing to buy them and pay, like in the case of the Washington Post, $250 million for a property that would have cost $5 or $6 billion probably 10 years ago, willing to pay for that and then sustain the losses annually, and there will be losses annually, gets the privilege of having tremendous political influence, gets the privilege of setting the political agenda in Washington to a large extent. And that's why these guys are buying the papers. Jeff Bezos isn't buying the Washington Post. He thinks it's a really brilliant commercial investment on its own. That's ridiculous. He's not a dummy. The Koch brothers aren't thinking about the LA Times or the Chicago Tribune. They think that's a really smart investment. That's ridiculous. What they do know is that it gives you great political influence, because even though newspapers are dying, they're the last game in town. And no one else is out there doing journalism. It's not like the Internet has spawned really vibrant, healthy replacements. You know, it's still a bunch of people just scrapping it together with baling wire and chewing gum. There's no money there for journalism any more than there's money for newspapers doing journalism. And as a result, if you own one of these papers, you can really set the agenda. And in the case of Bezos specifically, I don't think there's any question that he has political ambitions. I mean, if he was just some benevolent philanthropist, he would make this he would do this through his foundation and make it a nonprofit trust and set it up in such a way that it would be independent and have some integrity, sort of like the Scott Family Trust with The Guardian in Britain, which is, you know, one of the great papers of the world. But that wasn't his ambition. I think he wants to own it. He wants to have the most powerful paper in Washington, probably one of the two or three most powerful papers in the United States, and have the ability to influence politics. And we've learned in the last few days, as we look more closely, and I've written about in Digital Disconnect, he and his company have very strong stakes in some of the most important political issues before the American people.
But Robert McChesney, has there ever been in this country a basic need for journalistic professionalism? My reading of history is that it's all sort of happened by accident, and because the, you know, in television, Bill Paley had some sense of integrity and some sense of public service. You've had these bilious billionaires like the McCormicks and the Hearsts and others over the decades using newspapers as personal propaganda outlets. I mean, we don't have a BBC that's insulated against political interference. And of course, PBS is completely dependent, and so is NPR on government funding. So they're hopeless compared to the BBC. What sets our journalistic standard? I mean, are we simply lucky to still have an LA Times and a New York Times, and are they endangered species?
Well, you got a lot of questions in there, Ian.
Right.
Let's start with professional journalism. We had a stridently partisan journalism for the first 140 years of American history. You know, in the 19th century, if a newspaper was a Republican paper and all newspapers were party identified, there's a good chance they wouldn't even mention Democratic candidates for office. You know, they just would ignore them. It was stridently partisan. And that system worked fairly well. It had its ridiculous stuff, too. But in general, I think historians look fondly upon a highly partisan press, as long as there are multiple viewpoints and it's easy to start a new newspaper, it's not a bad system. And a lot of our greatest democracies have had partisan systems. What happened in the early 20th century, newspapers became very profitable. They also became highly concentrated, and they remained partisan. And this created the great crisis of the early 20th century, the Citizen Kane era, when, you know, there's only one or two newspapers in most American cities, except the largest cities, and they have very strong political viewpoints. They're very partisan, and it's impossible to start anyone to compete with them. And that's what led to the birth of professional journalism, because smart publishers realized, you know, this is killing us all if people don't trust the content of newspapers and if we become a source of scandal and controversy. And this was the idea of separating the ownership from the editors and reporters, separating the advertisers from the editors and reporters. So the theory was that what you read off the editorial page could be in any of the professional newspapers, because the professional journalists would be doing it without any bias or any political agenda that they're pushing. Now, this isn't the show to go into how ridiculous that is or how impossible that is, but it's not totally impossible. I mean, you can try it, and it can be somewhat effective. And one of the great stories in American history is how professional journalists, working reporters in the newspaper guild, tried very hard to create a different type of professional journalism that was sort of more adversarial towards everyone in power rather than just regurgitating what people in power were saying, accurately reporting it, which is what it devolved to in the United States. So at any rate, professional journalism has been struggling with commercial pressures now for about 30 years because there's so much need to make money and desire to make money that the sort of traditional sort of prohibition that was existed for a good 20, 30, 40 years from mid-century into the 70s, you know, has given way increasingly to commercial pressures and that have warped and shaped the news. And this is something that media critics like myself wrote about a lot, especially in the 80s and 90s and into the last decade. But I think it's been overwhelmed by the tidal wave of the economic disintegration of journalism, which is sort of really become the dominant story. We're just seeing the elimination of journalism as a commercially undertaken enterprise. And that's the true story that backs up what we're dealing with here, not just the decline of professionalism and the decline of quality, but it's the elimination of journalism. Not the elimination of news, mind you. There are still going to be news channels and news websites, but they're not going to really do much reporting. That it's going to be mostly public relations spin. And all the new research shows that pretty much 80% of what's called news is directly out of public relations or just a verbatim quote of someone in power.
Well, you can see, for example, if you watch, and people can't, of course, if you watch CNN International, it's actually a news channel. If you watch CNN Domestic, it's kind of trivial, you know. I mean, you can see the difference. So my question, I know it was a multifaceted, loaded question, but I'm trying to figure out here what what force is there in the United States to maintain a level of where we actually know that there's a standard of journalism and that there is a standard that's set? And I guess at this point it's set by what, the New York Times? I mean, in other words, the BBC, at least because it's politically insulated, does set a kind of standard. Fleet Street is a way you described, you know, 18th century American. You know, there's a, and most of the other democracies have a full spectrum of left-wing papers and all the way to the right. We don't. We have these homogenized, you know, papers where they have balance because I guess the owners don't want to offend half of their readers who are Democrats and half of their readers who are Republicans. So they have, you know, on the one hand and on the other hand. But what's protecting us from complete commercialization of and trivialization of news?
Nothing. I think the real issue here is if commercial interests have abandoned journalism, if the value of these products has gone down, if they're only being bought now basically so they give the power so you can influence politics and the people are interested in them, like the dude down in San Diego who bought the San Diego Daily Paper, who's the right-wing guy, Manchester is his name, and uses it basically to push his political agenda in San Diego. If that's the sort of that's the future of journalism. We went through a wave between 2008 and 2011 when hedge fund people gobbled up most of the newspapers and they said, hey, we'll come in with our brilliant financial genius minds and figure out a way to make money. And they all threw in the towel. And then they started selling them off to, you know, just billionaires who have a political axe to grind. That's our future, but that's not a future. I mean, that's just nowhere we can go. If we do nothing as a, politically, and just let the quote-unquote market work its way, what we're going to have is a continued collapse of journalism, and then we'll have these sort of billionaires who will gobble up these franchises like they're doing and keep them alive so they can use them to push their political viewpoints. And then some might do it very subtly. I mean, I doubt Jeff Bezos is going to march into the Post newsroom and slam his fist on the table and demand coverage of Story X and Story Y. In fact, I think he'd find most of the Post coverage completely fine with his worldview. That's why it's probably a pretty easy deal for the two sides to hammer out. Bezos is stridently anti-labor. He doesn't want regulation of business. He doesn't want any antitrust enforcement against him. He wants low taxes or non-existent taxes on wealthy people. He doesn't like public education. He gets along fine with the Washington Post, which oftentimes is considered a liberal paper, but that's very much in its rearview mirror.
Again, I'm speaking of Robert McChesney, who's the Gutzel Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and he's written several books on media and politics, hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. His latest book, co-authored with John Nichols, is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Bob, just the other day I spoke on this Time Warner cable spat with CBS. I spoke with Susan Crawford, who many people were hoping would become the new director of the FCC. She'd be kind of people were hoping they'd have – she's an Elizabeth Warren type of person. Instead, the person that got the job is a former lobbyist for the telecom monopolies. But she was pointing out that this key vote that's taking place, well, it's not a vote, it's a lawsuit, but it's the second, it's the court below the Supreme Court, the key Washington circuit court there of appeals that the Republicans have stacked for some time because of filibusters, the Democrats and Obama can't get anybody onto this court. And there are three or four vacancies. They're supposed to hear the overturning of the so-called Jenikowski rules that preserve net neutrality on the internet. So if the internet is the only alternative to what we've been discussing so far, which is the mainstream media and who owns it and what kind of future it's going to have, if the internet is the only alternative, sometime in September, unless Obama can get a couple of two or three people on this court, it's very likely that they're going to strike down net neutrality. So I don't understand why the American public, particularly out here in California and in New York and Dallas, where we can't get CBS now because we have this one pipe into our homes controlled by a monopoly, and they just don't give a damn about us. They're having their own little corporate battle, and it just shows you it's a harbinger of what's going to happen when the corporations take over the internet and they control the pipe into your home. You're finished. Your means of communication, information are completely gone.
Well, I can't disagree with you. It's a very important fight. And, you know, I think what is people are starting to see, and what I tried to emphasize in my book, Digital Disconnect, is that the notion of the internet as this sort of competitive, wide-open marketplace where anything goes and everyone's got a shot, you know, that there's a million Steve Jobs is out there just, you know, one break away from busting through with another great idea. This has very little to do with the actual internet that exists in the world today, which is one that is dominated by a small number of enormous companies that are, by economic standards, monopolies, meaning that these companies in their dominant area of profit making have a market share very close to and oftentimes exceeding that John D. Rockefeller had with Standard Oil in the late 19th century. You know, Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Twitter, eBay, I think we all know the company's names. I mean, I'd add into that Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon, who have a cartel that Susan Crawford writes about so brilliantly over internet access. And these huge companies collect most of the profits online. It's not spread around through a lot of people. In fact, 12 of the 30 largest companies in America in terms of market value are internet monopolies. It's quite extraordinary. And so this is the new world order. And these companies have inordinate political power in Washington. I mean, President Obama, Democrat, Republican alike, can barely control themselves in the presence of one of these companies' CEOs or their lobbying officers. They're really hot. They run the game. And so we have real problems here. And issues like net neutrality, when there's a lot of them that really have a strong opinion, and the other ones aren't fighting back or they've given up. And we have another issue here, I think, that goes beyond the monopoly, and this gets back to the beginning of the conversation, which is that even if we have net neutrality protected so that the phone and cable companies can't censor websites or users on the internet, there's the fundamental problem of resources for journalism, to pay for it. Those countries that still have great journalism today or credible journalism, those countries that rank always at the top of the Economist's annual list of the most democratic nations in the world, make public investments in journalism 40, 50, even 100 times more per capita than the United States. We're way off the democratic grid with every other country in the democratic world. And we're not even close to it in terms of what we spend on journalism, in terms of public and community media and the like. And, you know, we've got to get back on the grid because people need to earn a paycheck to do journalism. They need to eat. It can't be done just by volunteers any more than you would expect another public good, like education or fire departments, to be done by volunteers. And it's every bit as important as education or a fire department.
Well, but I was using the BBC example earlier, and all the other developed countries that you mentioned, the top of the list in terms of standard of living, do have a public broadcasting. We have the NPR, which is and PBS, which have been, you know, Nixon set up PBS to fail and to be politically controlled, and NPR are looking over the shoulders at the Republican Congress all the time. So we have nothing like that. That seems to me to be a real, a vain wish. I mean, where's the political momentum? I mean, the point I was making, what Susan Crawford was making in the interview I did with a couple of days ago, was that we're not even paying attention to this case that's going to be heard in early September in the D.C. Circuit Court that could throw out net neutrality. And that will be absolutely a revolutionary fact, won't it?
Yes and no. You know, of course, as I'm sure Susan Crawford mentioned to you, the FCC created this entire problem on net neutrality when it, on its own, under Michael Pollan, reclassified cable to an information service. Right. And therefore, instead of a telecommunication service, and therefore undermined its own ability to regulate it. And it has the right to change that decision at any time. The Supreme Court has reconfirmed that. So it actually has it wouldn't even have to have this court case if it did that. This is they basically handed this as a gift to the cable industry, and they don't have the courage to take it back because it's so absurd. It is an important issue. Don't get me wrong. I agree with net neutrality is an important issue. But the point I'm making is that I don't think that people aren't paying attention to the net neutrality case because they're too busy worrying about how to get public broadcasting in the United States. I don't think it's a trade-off there. Right. That's the real crisis. People should stop thinking about that and get back to net neutrality. The problem we have, though, is that the net neutrality case, and legal cases generally aren't followed at that level no matter what they are, but the net neutrality case is important. It's even if we have net neutrality, and we've had net neutrality on wireline communication pretty much until now. We've always had it, which is one of the reasons it's hard to explain, because we've never lost it. And we don't really have it on cell phones anymore. That's part of the Obama policy we lost. But we do have it on wireline internet. That doesn't solve the fundamental problem that the show started with, which is, you know, why we don't have any journalism left, and what little we have is being bought up by a few billionaires who can get it on the cheap.
Right. Well, but in the last minute or so here, what are we left with, though, in terms of our political focus, our political energy? I mean, you know, where this is, public supported radio, which is, independent, but we, don't have any reach compared to these other people in the media. So, I mean, it feels like a daunting task to build a movement here, but we got to do something.
It feels like a daunting task, but it's amazing. We can never predict the future, and looking backwards, we always think it's impossible to change anything. There's never been anyone who's looked ahead and said, oh, yeah, things are going to change really easily in the future. We can't predict the future, and, that's the one lesson that should be reminded is every time we look around the world today at the radical changes that have taken place in so many countries that no one thought possible, even the smartest people in those countries that, a year before Arab Spring, a year before the uprisings in this country or that country, the recent ones in Brazil, no one thought it possible. Then suddenly it happens, and everybody says, yeah, what took it so long? That same thing was true of the Occupy movement. So I think, we're in a situation that's not tenable in the United States. We have collapsing journalism. We have deep social problems not being addressed by a governing system. Something's going to give. It's in our interest that it gives way to democratic and humane outcomes. But this can't go on forever. How it's going to change, though, no one can predict. No one has any idea. But I do think it's clear from my research, the American people should not be underestimated. This is a vastly more progressive population than it's been at any time in my lifetime. And the right wing knows it. That's why they're doing everything in their power to make it possible to buy elections on one hand and suppress the votes of poor people on the other hand, because they know they can't win a fair election unless they rig it.
Well, Robert McChesney, let's have another conversation about this because obviously we need to, and I thank you for joining us.
My great pleasure, Ian. Good luck with everything.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert McChesney, who is the Guskill Endowed Professor at the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's written several books on media and politics, hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. He is the co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America, and the author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what the Washington Post Company did not sell to Jeff Bezos. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of the Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Here's an article at Republic Report and the Huffington Post. Bezos' purchase of the Post leaves Graham with Kaplan for-profit college. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halpin.
Thanks, Ian. How are you?
Well, I'm actually just having gotten through with this conversation with Robert McChesney. I'm sort of devastated because it makes me think that, you know, there is no journalistic standard in this country. There's no reason for the Wall Street for the New York Times to be set the journalistic standard. It's just a pure accident that you have, you know, enlightened families and that are in control of these big newspapers. You don't have a BBC that's insulated from the government that sets a journalistic standard. So, I mean, am I right in thinking that there really is nothing to stop billionaires from turning the entire media into their personal playthings if they can pay the price?
Not much. I mean, these things are privately or owned or publicly traded businesses, and businesses need to make money. And there is sort of shame, and there's public pressure, and there are enterprising people of goodwill who sometimes take over one of these things and try to keep it on the side of honesty and good and holding people accountable. And I'm just kind of hoping that that's what will be the case this time with Bezos and Amazon. But there are a lot of things about Bezos' conduct as a business person and his political views that suggest it might not be the case. But, of course, that's not what I'm on to talk with you
about. No, it's not. But I just wanted to, you know, have you catch up with my, you know, how I'm sort of rattled here from the last conversation, because, you know, there isn't any public pressure or public control or influence over the media, as there is in other democracies. As you well know, the BBC in England and most of the other advanced democracies at least have a strong public space in the media that sets a standard, and therefore the commercial people have to at least follow that or meet that.
True. But I would say the good news is, of course, the internet, and that I believe that a good story can be produced on the cheap by a couple of people or one person, and with the internet, a good story can often rise to the top. There's all kinds of ways that now money can influence what rises to the top. But real news still catches on, real news and, of course, naked people. Those things can rise to the top. And so there's still a chance, even in a world where you're wary of government controlling the media and you're wary of big companies controlling the media, that true journalism, enterprising journalism, and real news can reach the public.
Well, it'd be also nice if the profession, within the profession, people who do this for a living got paid.
True. And there are ways to get paid. I mean, I do journalism. I do public policy advocacy, but I do write and report on stories on issues that I care about, where I am treated. You know, people can give me interviews. I'm paid by a number of nonprofit organizations and foundations to do this work. I don't make a huge amount of money, but I'm able to have some influence on a few of the issues that I work on, and that is free of corporate and government control.
Well, David, let's get to what we wanted to talk about and your article at both Republic Report and the Huffington Post. Bezos' purchase of the Post leaves Graham with the Kaplan for-profit college. We've talked a lot about this racket, these for-profit colleges, which entirely operate off federal money, off taxpayers' money, which they mark up absolutely egregiously, scandalously to these students, many of whom are on the GI Bill now, the new GI Bill, and they send them, they these diploma mills every day now on TV. You see new diploma mills propping up, spending all this money, which again is taxpayer money, on advertising themselves. And they get these students in, they get them hooked on massive debts, which, of course, again, they're marking up public money and just turning it into private profit. And at the end of the day, these students end up with worthless diplomas and onerous, crippling debt. And the Kaplan, which is the financial engine behind the Washington Post company, what's the dropout rate there? 70% of the
70%, one of the highest.
They don't even complete get their diplomas, and getting the diploma is kind of
bad on paying back their loans. Now, I think a lot of this is an important story because people think of Don Graham as a ethical person, and it was that status, and also as a powerful person, the head of the Washington Post, that helped that made it possible for him to be very effective as essentially the most influential lobbyist in Washington on preventing reforms that would hold these for-profit colleges accountable. He went around and met with members of the Obama administration, with members of Congress, with leaders of think tanks like the Center for American Progress, where I work, and he said, gee, Kaplan is trying to do the right thing. We're educating low-income people. Well, they were not educating low-income people. Most of the time, they were just taking their money, taking the taxpayer money, taking the students' money, leaving them in debt, and leaving them either to drop out or get a degree that was worthless. A couple of times, in cases, it turned out the degree was almost literally worthless. The students were told it would train them for a particular career, and then it turned out not to be true. Or the Kaplan Online Concord Law School, where many students didn't realize that it was an unaccredited law school and that they couldn't pass, they couldn't even take the bar exam of 49 out of the 50 states. They could take it in as year as California. But in any case, Don Graham went around and said, don't do this, don't penalize our for-profit colleges, because we're doing a wonderful job. And people believed him because he was Don Graham, the powerful and respected leader of the Washington Post. Kaplan is a bad school, and the rule also would have affected a lot of other bad schools had it been strong enough. Now, a rule did pass, but it got watered down. And I can tell you from talking with people in the administration that Don Graham was a key player in watering the rule down. And in that sense, I think that he did something that was very bad for the country, and something that, makes it kind of fitting in a way that what he's left with now is a company that formerly got 55% of its revenues from the Kaplan Education Division. Now it's going to be more like 2/3 of its revenues with the things that Bezos bought. So he basically is the head of Kaplan, and the Post even calls itself now an education and media company. They even called it that before this sale. They lead with their education because that's where the money has been coming from. And, it's nice that it subsidized the Washington Post newspaper to some extent, but the truth is it would have been better to just have a direct taxpayer subsidy to the Post than have the money go to Kaplan, because in the process, as you suggested and explained so eloquently, it ruined the lives of so many students and still does.
So in an ironic way, then, David Halpin, this is a cleansing moment. I mean, in other words, as you point out in your article, the last line of the article is that for the Post newspaper, many remaining talented journalists, however, it is an opportunity to begin anew without the burden of an enormous rotten core.
I think that's fair, and I talked to a number of Post reporters at the time who were embarrassed. They were embarrassed that the Post wouldn't really write about the for-profit colleges in a tough way, editorialized in favor of not having any accountability for predatory for-profit colleges. And it gets worse than that. The previous CEO of Kaplan got a $76 million compensation package when he resigned in 2008. In 2012, a congressman wanted to ask the for-profit college heads how much money they make. And the Post refused to tell them how much the head of Kaplan made because they didn't have to disclose that to the Securities Exchange Commission because Kaplan is a subsidiary of the Post. So they refused. So although the Post is always holding people accountable, people who suck off the government dole, they wouldn't tell how much their person, whose company was making 90% of their money from taxpayers, they wouldn't tell how much that person, the CEO of Kaplan, earned. So that's one thing. Another thing is that through their adventure owning a for-profit college, the Washington Post, through Kaplan, was a member of the notorious American Legislative Exchange Council, the group responsible for voter ID laws that make it harder for individuals, low-income people, people of color, elderly people, young people to vote, and also the Stand Your Ground law that made it easier for George Zimmerman to walk away from shooting Trayvon Martin. Those are both things heavily lobbied for by ALEC, which the Washington Post supported with its money and its prestige by making Kaplan a member of it. The Post never disclosed that. I disclosed that. I found it out and reported it, and the Post then confirmed it to me. But in all their coverage of ALEC and Trayvon Martin and all these things, they didn't mention that they had, until 2011, the end of 2011, I believe, were a member of ALEC. So he brought the Post into a lot of dirty business, I think, through. And when I talked to the Post ombudsman about this, I said, why aren't you talking about this? You're supposed to be keeping the paper honest and talking to readers about their concerns. He said, I plan to write about this. And then he never did. He left, and the Post abolished the position of ombudsman. So I think the ownership of an industry that was inherently corrupt and incompetent, well, competent at making money, incompetent at educating students, and often involved in deceptive recruiting of students, through all that, he really led the Post into a major misadventure that I think tarnished the legacy of the paper and of the Graham family owning it. So I'm sure he's a wonderful guy. I know you've mentioned that you knew him in Vietnam. He was a soldier. He didn't need to go there. His family could have kept him out. He was a police officer in Washington, D.C. He's beloved by people in his newsroom. But this particular misadventure is something for which taxpayers and students and people who care about the economy in this country and honesty in this country ought not to forgive him. He ought to be held accountable for it.
And just to remind people of the basis of Kaplan's money, which is 55% of the revenues of the Washington Post Company, the basis of its money is your money, taxpayer money. When you say that the former CEO of Kaplan received $76 million in a compensation package and a golden parachute,
yes,
that's taxpayer money.
90% of it is. Now, Kaplan also includes the test prep, which allows wealthier kids to get better prepared for tests than poorer kids because they can pay for the Kaplan test prep. Now, but at least that is more of a legitimate business. It's also true that often test prep doesn't help particularly. That's the Stanley Kaplan business that a lot of people listening will remember growing up was available to them to take a test. That seems more legitimate to me. The Kaplan for-profit college, I'm sure there's some people who've had a good experience there, but as you said, 70% dropout rate. And most of the money is from our taxpayers. But when President Obama said, what we'd like to do is make it so that schools that are systematically failing students, failing them in the sense of not educating them, making them deep in debt, unable to pay back their loans, it was Bob Graham who went around and lobbied and said, we think an onerous rule like this will hurt us and hurt us in our efforts to educate young people. But again, as I've argued directly with the head of the For-Profit College Association, admitting students is not the same as educating them. Taking their money and depositing their checks is easy to do. It's helping them train for careers.
Sorry to interrupt you, David, but we've run out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
Again, I'm speaking with David Halpern, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor to Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He also has an article at Republican Report and the Huffington Post. Bezos' purchase of the Post leaves Graham with Kaplan for-profit college. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another background briefing. Bye for now.